This is Janet McKean from Caro, and you're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM, hands-on radio.
The river flows tranquilly on, the flowers are red, and this is Infinite Contact. Join me, Theo 3, for forgotten frequencies and cinematic live vinyl and cassette mix journeys that bend genres and warp timelines. From deep electro vaults to dusty spiritual jazz, obscure hip-hop beats to cosmic synthscapes, each episode is a transmission from the past and future of the infinite I Am Presence. Lock in Saturdays, 4 to 6 p.m., only on 90.7 FM, WGXC.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by The Highway Drive-In, a four-screen drive-in movie theater in Coxsackie, New York. Information and schedule at HIWAYDriveIn.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Anna Colville of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
90.7 FM.
Acre, Hudson, Catskill.
Thank you.
You are listening to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM Acra Catskill Radio for open ears. This program is Frequency Meet Bird People in the Hudson Valley. Frequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a freeform mix of sounds made by birds and humans inspired by birds. We started today's show with Pajaro from an album, El Corredor del Jaguar, by Combo Chimbita, based in New York City. And as for the bird people of the day, Frequency welcomes Anita Sanchez and George Steele, both environmental educators based in Amsterdam, New York. They are co-authors of A Sky That Sings, a children's book that invites readers to use all their senses to experience nature. The story follows Mia, a blind girl who leads her aunt through the park, identifying birds by their calls and songs. Anita and George will share the inspiration behind the book and their collaboration with the Northeastern Association of the Blind at Albany. In today's modern world, we often develop an unfounded fear of nature. That fear can narrow our understanding and imagination not only toward the natural world, but also toward people whose experiences differ from our own. Through their books and the nature education programs they lead, Anita and George invite us to embrace nature, not with fear, but with curiosity and joy. So I hope you will enjoy this really fantastic, informative interview with me. Thank you for listening. This is Frequency on WGXC.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today. Could you introduce yourselves, both of you?
Sure. My name's Anita Sanchez, and I'm a naturalist and an author. I write books on science and nature, mostly for kids.
And I'm Anita's husband, George Steele. I do environmental education programs, enrichment programs, mostly for elementary age students in schools, and then also for families at nature centers and other green spaces.
I wanted you to talk about your latest book today in this interview, which is titled A Sky That Sings. Well, could you tell the listeners what the theme of this book is?
Well, it's a book about a lot of things. It's about a visually impaired child who's Latina, and she goes birding and uses her other senses besides sight, since she's blind, to experience the natural world. So I think the main theme of the book is trying to get kids, all readers, to use all of their senses to enjoy nature and have fun in nature and to go outdoors in nature.
Mm-hmm. And where did the idea came from?
Well, I used to work at Five Rivers and Nature Center years ago, and one day I was assigned to do a nature walk for a group of visually impaired children, and at first I couldn't imagine how that would work. But when they got there and we went outdoors, I was amazed how much I learned from them. They could hear things that I never noticed, and they wanted to touch things that I never thought about touching. And so they were using their senses in a way that seemed really interesting. And so that was the original idea for the book.
This protagonist, the blind girl, his name is Mia, in the book she mentions Ms. Gomez.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that Ms. Gomez took her and other kids to field trips. So I guess your experience of leading that group of kids must be the model behind this Ms. Gomez's field trip.
I think probably in my imagination, Mia would be, who's the main character, would be she'd be in a class probably included with sighted children. She might have an aide to go with her, but she would be, you know, on a field trip with kids who could see, and the fictional, you know, Mrs. Gomez might be careful of her language. For instance, if you say there's a bird over there, that means nothing to a blind person. Mm-hmm. If you say there's a bird in the tree behind you, high up, and it's about the size and shape and color of a lemon, it's called a yellow warbler. So using descriptive language, which is great for all the kids, not just kids who are visually impaired.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yep. Once I had worked with a group, it was fifth graders, so it's about the same age range, and there was a boy in the class that was blind. They're with the kids all the time. They're, you know, they get to know each other, and he interacted with the other kids. The other kids would help him out and show him some things. And then I recall, too, when I was young, I had been in summer camp in Boy Scouts, and I'd been there with my troop, and then I stayed an extra week. And when you stay an extra week and you're not with your troop, they have what they call a provisional troop, any of the kids that are staying extra. So that week there was camper that was blind, and it was amazing just learning from him about things. Like, you know, you sort of have this vision, okay, you're blind, it means you can't see anything at all, it's totally dark. And I vividly recall approaching the dining hall, and he said, oh, we're almost there, because I would help him, you know, around camp. And I was like shocked. And he says, well, I can see lightness and darkness. So when we entered the shadow of the building, I knew that we were getting near the building. And, you know, so I think young kids learn a lot from working with children of other abilities. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, teachers take a big advantage of that in classrooms.
I mean, you mentioned the descriptive language, and I think it's quite helpful for anybody, really, because when I go birding and, you know, try to tell your group that over there, that tree.
It's like,
it's above the cloud. but it's very hard to come up with that descriptive language, and I'm trying to do a little better. English is not my first language, so my vocabulary is poor in the first place. But even if you don't know the species of the tree, you could say, well, there's a shaggy bark or the pointy shape or whatever. But since you're a writer and you wrote this book together, right?
Right. Well, I essentially ride on Anita's coattails. She's the one who... We sit there and Anita will be writing, and then she'll ask a question or ask something about this, or I'll make a suggestion. Mm-hmm. So, but Anita really lays out most of it. And then if I've done enough mm-hmm. to warrant the honor of being a co-author, mm-hmm. then, you know, we go that route. But
well, he's the birder, so he's my birding Google. You know, mm-hmm. So when it came to deciding what birds to put in and what sounds they made and how likely it would be to see these two birds in the same season, because I wanted the book to be accurate, you know, mm-hmm. would you see a heron at the same time you'd see a yellow warbler or something like that? So he just knows everything about, you know, all those details of ornithology.
Right, so you provided the technical assistance part of the book. Yeah, that descriptive language. If you're a writer, I think you are used to explaining things in the way that's clear to the reader, so I bet it helps. But when we use the word inclusive birding, I've birded with people who are very knowledgeable in trees. It's the opposite of my problem. And they say, there's that ash tree or whatever, and I don't know which one is the ash tree. And so it's not exactly an inclusive way of operating things either. Mm-hmm. And so the word inclusive has lots of meanings that you need to kind of slow down and look at, like, how dumb I could be. And then you kind of have to, like, come down to where I am while I try to get to where they are. Again, when we use the word inclusive, sometimes it's an abstract idea to many of us, like, what does that exactly mean? And that's a great insight, that try to be a more descriptive, I think, is very interesting. And so you already touched a little bit on how you decided on what birds would appear in this book, but if you can tell us more about it.
Well, actually, it's sort of interesting and, you know, reading the book, thinking, how come we didn't include that bird? Or this is another interesting bird. And there's so many birds. And the big part of the book then, too, is the birds that have, like, how do you describe, say, a wood thrush or a hermit thrush song? I mean, it's a flute-like, you know, it becomes very difficult. So it works best for birds that have like an onomatopoetic kind of thing, like drink your tea, although we didn't have the Eastern Towhee, something along those lines. So, and then also, because it's going to be, this is not a book for advanced birders, it's for someone who's going to be, maybe never having gone birding. And so you'd want birds that are going to be likely to be encountered. So, you know, the yellow warbler with the song, Sweet, Sweet, I'm So Sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's funny, too, because then you get different ones like red-winged blackbird, a very common bird. And even the books will have it. I mean, gurglee, conkeree, okeree, because you're taking the actual bird's song and trying to put it into a phrase that you can write down.
Right.
You know, so again, you know, like you have these birds that have a trilling, you know, warbling, flute-like songs, you know, saying it's trilling, warbling, flute-like. Well, that's like mud. I mean, you leave it to someone's imagination. You have no idea what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm. It had to be things that your average reader, young reader, might relate to. The sewing machine bird, the chipping sparrow that goes ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, sounds like a sewing machine that relates to, you know, most kids.
Although I ask many a child when I do that, listen, okay, that bird that sounds like a sewing, do you guys know what a sewing machine is?
I was just wondering just now.
I have no idea.
That's
what a sewing machine is.
I'm a quilter, like, so I tend to think in terms of sewing. But that's probably true.
Yeah, but you don't even use a sewing machine. You're just this quiet hand sewing.
And I guess also it has to be birds that people would see in a park setting. You don't have to go to
You don't want something like a Swainson thrush on the top of the mountaintop.
Right. But did you struggle to narrow it down? Like, you could have a Carolina Wren or Towhee could have been the thing. It's like, to let that bird go because there's the page.
Left that to Anita as far as which birds, because, I mean, it would have been, in hindsight, something like the Carolina Wren would have been a cool bird because it's such a loud, raucous bird. There's funny stories. The books say it says tea kettle. Okay, so then what do kids, know about tea kettles? But so this one first grader raised their hand, goes, Mr. Steele, what bird goes Dorito, Dorito, Dorito? And I knew it was perfect. I mean, no book will ever say the Carolina Wren says that, but that's the pattern. Da 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 da. Tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle.
Right, right.
Or I swear, sometimes I hear them say, pretty bird, pretty bird, pretty bird. But it's that phrasing that you can transmit into, again, a written, series of words that makes sense to people.
Right. Oh, it'd be funny to ask kids, like, what do you think is the word that applies to these songs?
When I do kids' programs, or like reading the book in a library, I have bird calls on my phone, so I play the bird call, so they can actually hear it as I read the book. So that's a good idea to ask the kid, what do you think the bird is saying?
Yeah, that would be really funny to hear their interpretation of the bird calls.
If you are just joining us, my guest today is Anita Sanchez and George Steele, the inspirations and insights behind A Sky That Sings, a children's book where a blind girl invites readers to experience birding through all their senses. The next segment of this interview will include a spoiler for the book, so be aware. Thank you for listening. This is Frequency on WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is one question that I wanted to ask and may not include in the radio because I don't want to spoil the story.
Oh.
But I was wondering why you chose Red-tailed Hawk to be her favorite bird. Because as I was reading, she's saying, I haven't heard my favorite yet. And I'm like, what could her favorite be? And like, could it be like really special birds with special songs? Like, I don't know, Eastern Meadowlark or something? And then it ended with the red-tailed hawk. And red-tailed hawk, we wouldn't associate with like beautiful songs, but it does give me this open sky feeling. But I was wondering why you decided that to be her favorite.
Well, it's my favorite.
Your favorite,
And Mia's me, sort of, because I'm a real novice birder, and I feel a bit like her. But it's open sky feeling is a good way of putting it. It gives you that sort of freedom. It's mm-hmm. You know, the joke is that often when you see a bald eagle on TV, they use the red-tailed hawk because it gives you that freedom sense. Also, when you're writing a children's book, you need to be aware of page turning. So originally, the book was Mia and her grandmother, actually, walking along listening to different birds, and they heard the different birds, and then they got in the car and went home. And my editor said, well, yeah, but, you know, where's the tension? There's no... You know, there's no sense of, you know, are we going to succeed? Is there some goal we have? And so that's when I thought of, we have to hear my favorite. You know, yes, this is good, but we haven't heard it yet. And there's hints. Mm-hmm. And so that makes you want to turn the page, mm-hmm. to keep going to find out what. So I had to really think of what's the struggle? What's the goal? The other sort of struggle that Mia has is she navigates some somewhat difficult terrain. She has to go up a hill, over a log, mm-hmm. Through the forest, through the mud. And I wanted to really emphasize that a blind child is perfectly capable of doing this. And in the book, the illustrator did a very good job of having Mia be in front, mm-hmm. be the leader. The adult is behind her going, ha, ha, wait for me.
Right.
And Mia is leading her on, showing how blind kids have so many abilities. You know, we don't need to think of them as weak or clumsy or helpless. They mm-hmm. have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of too. You set up with the what's the sky like when she's starting off, and so there's sort of almost this thing of you know, anticipating her favorite bird being up in the sky, because mm-hmm. she. You know, she takes flight with the bird in her mind.
Mm. Yeah, that's quite beautiful. I'm still debating if I would include this or not, because I don't know if I want to spoil what her favorite bird was, but I wanted to ask you about this.
Spoiler alert.
spoiler alert. Maybe I put that spoiler alert. Skip this 5 minutes if you don't want to know. you consulted a nonprofit that helped you how to portray blind people in an accurate light. And I was wondering what this organization was and what the collaboration looked like.
They're called NABA, Northeastern Association of the Blind at Albany. So they're based here in Albany. And they were wonderful. I sent them an email just hoping someone might get back to me. They got back to me right away. And the teachers, several of the teachers who work with blind students and were very experienced, read multiple drafts of the book, mm-hmm. And then they read them aloud to blind students to get their feedback. So they read it to blind elementary school students to see how they liked the book. Mm-hmm. And then once the book was accepted for publication, and they did all this, you know, we didn't know if the book would get accepted for publication, but once it was and they found an illustrator, then the NABA folks worked with the illustrator to illustrate how a blind child would walk, would hold her cane, mm-hmm. How she would, you know, would she look at the bird or would she have her ear more towards the bird? Often Mia's looking away from the bird that her aunt is looking at, mm-hmm. but she's turning her head so that she can hear the sound better. Mm-hmm. So they worked with the illustrator to get details like that right, you know, how blind child uses a cane. You don't use it like a walking stick. You use it differently.
Right.
So, yeah, they were wonderful, very, very helpful. And it was a long process. It took several years that I kept saying, okay, here's another draft. Do you mind reading it? And they always would.
Mm. So did they have to make a lot of changes? I'm sure you went in doing some research of your own writing this story. Was there anything surprised you in their suggestions or...
Mostly was the language. The aunt had a lot of things that she was saying that are not as effective with a blind child. For instance, over there, that's the classic. Now, the aunt was always saying, oh, what's that bird over there? Or come on over here, or let's go this way. And of course, those words mean nothing to a blind person. So I had to change mostly the aunt's dialogue to, like I said, you know, the bird is in the tree behind you high up. Also mentioning this, the aunt kind of describes it, not only for Mia, but for the reader as well, because I was always aware that the reader had to be learning things. Yeah, the reader also wouldn't know that the bird was the size of a lemon or, you know, was near the pond or whatever.
Right.
So, but yeah, the Naba folks were really great.
That's really great. Because like we were saying earlier, the word like over there is not helpful to anybody really.
Right.
And when I was taking ESL classes back when I arrived in the United States, one thing I really remember well was that one teacher said, don't ever say people, always say like passenger or viewer or whatever, like what they are. Don't ever say just people, but be specific with like think what they are and use that word. Don't be lazy and just say people. And that's something I still remember to this day. And you know, when we talk, I mean, maybe we should use our brain a little bit, you know, as we say things and try, you're trying to communicate something with other person who may not know what you're talking about. So having that specificity is not only helpful to blind people, but like really helps anybody. Like we were saying, again, when we bird, if you can be a little bit more specific, like use your brain a little bit. I mean, saying that to myself, really. But,
you know, in related to the you know, organizations, there's a big movement with trying to get birding more available or introduce more people to birding than just sighted people and able-bodied people. So there's an organization that started, I don't know how many years it's been around, but it's called Birdability. Mm. And there's an official Birdability Week, which is coming up. October 20th through the 26th. I was Googling to see, you know, who's doing it. I was down at Hawk Mountain to observe hawk migration back in mid-September and was chatting to the Hawk Mountain people. And they've got a whole variety of things related to birds and nature. So they were going to have a touch table, and they were having a variety of other things in addition to, you know, birders, you know, listening for birds and exploring the mountain for birds. But here I know state parks. I saw one state park is doing something. I'm not sure what other ones, but I think it's an annual event every whatever, maybe it's the third week of October. I haven't read, you know, how it's set up. I have to imagine they probably have it set the same time every year so people can expect it's coming up, but.
Right. I saw that information, and I've learned a little bit about Birdability, but I haven't been seeing anything local, so that's great to know.
Yeah, I think it's starting to build a little bit more steam. It's, you know, just because people don't think about that. I mean, everyone is sort of centered on their own exploring birds and what are the opportunities to bring other people out to enjoy birds.
Oh, it would be cool to get to know those local people doing that.
Yeah.
If you don't mind sharing the names later.
Well, I know that the Saratoga State Park is doing something at Saratoga. I saw that one specifically.
Okay.
And was there, well, Hawk Mountain said they were doing something. I happened to be out north of Boston, Cape Ann, Gloucester area, and Drumlin Farm, which is Massachusetts Audubon Society, had plans for something.
Okay.
But I think if people, you know, Google Birdability, they'll find organizations that are trying to get the outdoors open to more people of different abilities.
You're listening to Bequency on WGXE 90.7 FM. If you just tuned in, my guest today is Anita Sanchez and George Steele. They're talking about the inspirations and insights behind A Sky That Sings, a children's book where a blind girl invites readers to experience birding through all their senses, which they co-authored. Thank you for listening.
I saw in your other book that it's titled Wait Till It Gets Dark, A Kid's Guide to Exploring the Night, and there's a chapter that's titled We Need the Dark, and you explain that humans have done a thorough job of eliminating darkness from our lives, which has led to light pollution and disrupted nocturnal wildlife and the loss of our own internal natural rhythm. And I believed this also reflects how we have designed our society primarily for the convenience of sighted people, for our own comfort and prioritizing our fears and how to sort of remedy that fear. And as a result, this design of the society has created challenges for blind individuals and wildlife. And so I was wondering if you have any suggestions for specific steps or actions that you would recommend for those of us in upstate New York, especially the ones from the city like myself. You know, how can we confront this fear of stepping outside our comfort zones and engage all five senses, like Mia could, really? Is there any programs or other resources you suggest?
Well, fear is a very good word to describe part of the problem. People are so afraid. People are afraid of everything these days. And in the years we've worked with kids in nature, I think we've seen that fear level rise. Kids don't want to touch things. They don't want to leave the blacktop. They're worried about germs. They're worried about stranger danger. And a lot of people, I know many people who would never go out for a stroll at night because they might get eaten by coyotes or get a bat tangled in their hair, or there might be bears, or, you know, there's so many fears. And really, as far as wildlife goes, it's pretty safe to walk around at night. Probably the biggest danger is getting hit by a car. You know, you need to be careful to, you know, not get, you know, hit by a car. But if we could calm some of our fears and start to feel more comfortable in nature, many places like Five Rivers or Pine Hollow Arboretum, many nature centers do night walks, which is a really good entry level because mm-hmm. you go out with a group, you know, and you can have the comfort of a group and begin to kind of dip your toe in it. But I used to be scared to death of the dark when I was a kid. But, you know, now I love to go out at night. I try to walk on our pitch dark road every night, and I love night walks.
The Landis Arboretum, I'll always have at least two different or maybe three different nighttime activities mm-hmm. For families to come to. Matter of fact, again, my last program of the year is always a Halloween owl prowl.
Uh-huh.
So it's focused on birds, and a lot of it's what owls we expect, but we then go off into the woods too. And I challenge everyone, because everyone comes with flashlights, and I challenge them to not use the lights for the beginning. Let's, you know, let our eyes get adjusted to the light, and then see how we can, depending upon the, you know, ambient light conditions. If there's a full moon, goodness gracious, in October with no leaves on the tree, you could walk through the woods with no flashlight and see exactly where you're going, just take your time. You know, someone is always, you know, anxious to use a flashlight. And then I'll usually say, by the time we finish up, if we're heading back, okay, turn your flashlights on. You can feel comfortable going at, you know, a faster speed. But one of the things that I think becomes important, and for someone like Mia, it would be a natural instinct to feel the ground with her feet. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a blind person isn't going to be told, you know, feel the ground. I mean, they just grow up feeling where they walk with their feet. And I learned many years ago when I was a camp counselor in a camp that I would walk most of the trails of the camp with no flashlight because I did know the sense of the trails, but I could tell if I was off the trail by feeling with my feet. The trail feels different than not being on the trail. And people are so used to walking on sidewalks or on pavement, you know, and that's why, you know, you ramble along on pavement and all of a sudden you get a little place where the sidewalk is a little off kilter and you trip on it because you're just so used to sort of shuffling along instead of really feeling with your feet as you walk along. So that whole thing of, again, you know, use your senses. I think one of the easiest ways that families could start helping with, you know, their kids becoming more accustomed to the, is to explore their backyard with, you know, with no lights on, no flashlight, and wait till it gets dark, of going out and trying some games in the backyard, sneak up games and things where you're using your senses in the nighttime to, you know, maneuver around your backyard, a very safe place. Not all kids have a backyard they can do it in, but, you know, many kids do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether maybe it's a grandparent's backyard that they could, you know, explore some of the sense of darkness at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that, I mean, I'm sure a lot of birders are familiar with this. They're always saying turn off your outside lights at night for the bird migration. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's true for, it affects bats, it affects moths. It, you know, it has a lot of effect on many types of wildlife besides birds. And so many people have their houses, you know, hugely lit up, not just at the holiday time, but, you know, all through the year. And it's a security thing, you know, I see that. But there are types of lighting you can get that doesn't affect wildlife quite so much.
Interesting.
Red lighting or lighting with shade so that the most of the light points directly down instead of up towards the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So our local supermarket has, you know, out there, whole parking lot has lights that shine down just towards the parking lot but not up towards the sky because they're near the Landis Arboretum, mm-hmm. which is a major stargazing place for so many. So when they built the supermarket, they planned those lights especially.
Mm.
So just being aware of the fact that darkness isn't bad, that there's positive things about it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my books, the theme of my book is that nature is cool, that nature isn't scary, that we don't need to fear it. And I often write about things that people don't like poison ivy and dandelions, mm-hmm. and spiders and stuff like that, to try to, you know, try to bring down that fear a notch. A lot of kids grow up with, you know, the Beauty and the Beast and all those movies where the wolves chase the heroine,
yeah.
through the woods. And
like, you think you'll be chased.
Yeah. And so many people, I mean, you know, we have neighbors who wouldn't dare walk down our road for fear of coyotes. And, you know, no, a coyote is not going to jump out of the bushes, wrestle you to the ground, and rip your throat out. They're just not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are predators. They might, for instance, eat a cat or a toy poodle, possibly, you know, if one was running loose. But they're not going to attack humans. They just don't. So, you know, I really wish we could allay people's fears about, you know, bats and spiders. And, you know, they're not waiting to attack you. All they want, all wildlife wants, is to get as far away from people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really, humans are our biggest risk. You know, traffic is my big concern when I'm walking late at night. I really should, like, wear a bright orange vest and that sort of thing for cars.
Yeah, having that kind of fear is what limiting our own ability, like you said, that mm-hmm. And that kind of fear, I think, limit our imagination to blind people too, because we would be scared in the dark. You would think, well, they couldn't do it either. They couldn't run. If you can't see, how could you run? Because it must be scary, is what we would think.
No, that's true. I mean, it's, you know, for a person of differing abilities, that the abilities that they don't have, that they don't focus. I mean, they focus in on the abilities they do have. So, you mm-hmm. know, they don't have to worry about, you know, about that. And matter of fact, and Mia jokes about that, you know, the aunt says, it's getting dark out, you know, it's getting late, it's getting dark out. And she says, what's the problem?
Right.
Right. And?
Right. It's very interesting because I read somewhere that our brain tends to decide what's noise. It decides that this is meaningless to me, that it means nothing to me, it's not important to me, and decide that it's a noise, and it literally cuts that sound or sight out of your processing, and that's how it doesn't register. And so you would never know what you're missing out if you don't know there's actually meaning to it. That sound, you can apply the meaning, which is the winter end sound. But if you don't know that meaning, then it's just, you just literally don't hear it somehow.
Right. Yeah.
One of the things I did for researching the book was I read Helen Keller's autobiography. And it's fascinating. Of course, she was blind and deaf.
Right.
So she was really limited as to her sensory input. And it's amazing what she could identify individual human beings by their scent, which, you know, we don't think about people having a smell.
Yeah.
But she was just so, because her brain had no input from her eyes or her ears when she lived in the late 1800s. You know, only in the summer was she allowed to wear short sleeves, and she loved to feel the air on her arms, but in winter they had to be covered. And she could identify individual species of flowers by their smell.
Oh.
And feel vibrations as someone walked toward her in the floor. So that made me think about what George was saying earlier about how you can feel the ground with your feet, you know, other senses besides hearing, of course. A lot of the book's about hearing, but also there's a lot of Mia feeling the grass under her feet. My nose tells me they just mowed the lawn. Yeah, we're near
smelling the mud of the pond.
Right, we're near a pond, I can smell it.
Right.
So I thought it was interesting. A blind person would know you were getting near a pond because they hear the red-winged blackbirds and smell the mud.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they see it, but they know a pond is coming up.
Right. I mean, it feels very rich, that world, because she assigns lots of meaning to everything that she receives through the senses that are available to her.
Mm-hmm.
And we can have all five senses, but if we don't assign meanings and if we eliminate everything as to be just noise, it's not important to me, then you're living a very poor world.
I find that my involvement in nature and in environmental education is just trying to open up people's all their senses to the natural environment. Not that they're going to, be using all their senses 100% all the time, because I don't think that works that way, but just to be aware that this natural world around us has so much more than what we have come to learn. You know, so I'm thinking about that, thinking of a person from, say, the late, the 1800s, they would sense the world different than we do, because, they were more in tune to, their local surroundings, because they worked in it and they needed it and they used things from it.
Mm.
Whereas, we're in a more modern, urbanized, go from your house to a car, from your car to a parking garage, into an office,
right.
Back in, so you never get to the outdoors. And so just becoming more aware, there's room to become more aware without overloading your senses.
Very interesting. Maybe I should ask you about the night programs, where people can find that information, the night walks that you...
I think, if you have a nature center anywhere near you, or any kind of nature organization, there's a lot of groups that might do, say, kayaking, especially like a full moon kayaking kind of a thing. So just be aware, to search out anyone that's dealing with the outdoors. Just about every nature center that I can think of is going to have night walks at some point in time.
Okay.
Oftentimes a midwinter night walk, because it's just a different experience. And then in the springtime, there's the, the sounds of spring kind of thing. So
you're also doing a Halloween owl prowl, you said.
Yes, that's a traditional program I do at the Landis Arboretum. It's either the Friday or Saturday night before Halloween. I'm not going to do it on Halloween night. I wouldn't get anybody unless I promise to have lots of candy or something.
Well, if people come in costumes, which we won't be able to see much.
So I do that this year. It's October 25th, I think, is the Saturday before Halloween. I know here at Five Rivers, there's often a night walk. I know the Wilton Wildlife Preserve, which is at Saratoga County, I think, they'll do one. But all the state parks will do them. Any nature center up and down the Hudson Valley, I'm sure they'll have one. So if you get online and look, I wonder if you Google night walk, I bet you'll pop up.
Okay. so people can find that resources in that way. Where can people find more about your books? Do you have upcoming projects? Or, I mean, I guess you just finished this big work, but...
Well, on my website, it's anitasanchez.com. Mm-hmm. And you can, any bookstore can order my books, if you Google Indiebound, which will direct you to, independent bookstores, you can order them online. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a book about, I love history, and so I'm working on a book about Mount Vesuvius, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. George and I went to Italy a few years ago, we didn't climb Mount Vesuvius, we took a bus to
We did,
to
well,
it.
From the bus stop, we did climb.
Well, we climbed a little, but it's very, counts. Mount Vesuvius, the volcano is,
it's still active.
It's an active volcano.
It could blow at any point.
It's, right. But on the top of the volcano, you can buy gelato and pizza, and there's, there's tourist buses going there every day. And someday, that volcano is going to blow up again. So mm-hmm. I wrote a book about the big eruption. I mean, it's had many eruptions, but, the big one we think of where Pompeii was destroyed. So it was very fun. It was like writing a novel with characters who actually were there, but it's all nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So that was a good change from backyard nature.
Yeah, is this a children's book or young adult or adult?
Middle grade. Yeah, anyone can read it, I hope. But
sounds very exciting.
So yeah, that's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was very
great
fun.
Conversation.
Red-tailed hawk.
has nothing to do with birds or wildlife, but I had to play it because Anita mentioned Mount Vesuvius being the theme of her next book. The track was Funiculi Funicula, originally composed apparently in 1880. I had to look up, I didn't notice, but we heard a cover version by Haruo Mihosono from his album Phil Harmony, and ahead of that we heard a few recording of Red-Tailed Hawk from Stokes Field Guide. Thanks to Anita and George, co-authors of children's book A Sky That Sings, for this wonderful interview. Made me think of what changes I can make, how I really came to realize talking to them and sort of listening to myself talk in this interview, how vision-oriented my tendency in my language is. So that's the kind of thing I felt I can work on. We all have limitations because we all only have our own limited experiences, but by listening to others really help you go above that limitation for your understanding and imagination and make life of all of us really easier. So we can only try. By the way, this interview was done in October 2025, so that's why there was some references of events that already happened in October. But I'm glad to finally air this interview. The transcript and some photos of this interview will be posted to my Bequency Substack with relevant links, which is at bequency.substack.com. I also post monthly local birdwalk lists there on that same website, the Bequency Substack, so you can find a birdwalk near you that you could join us at any time. Again, it's at bequency.substack.com. You're listening to Waveforms WGXC Acre 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. And coming up next is a very special program celebrating freedom of expression on air, organized by the Northern Spy Reading Series and WGXC. From noon to 4 p.m., authors, broadcasters, poets, and community members will come together live on air here on Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, to celebrate freedom of speech and freedom to create. Stop by the WGXC studio on Main Street Catskill to witness the broadcasts and head over to Left Bank Ciders to gather with others to listen to the broadcast and converse. Or just don't touch that dial to 90.7 FM. Or keep listening here online. Me, I'm going back to bed because it's Saturday, it's cold, and I'm a little bit under the weather. You can go back to bed too, but you can still connect with this event through the radio, like I said, if you keep this thing running. That's the beauty of the radio. That's the power of the radio. You can still be part of the community, even when you can't or don't or won't leave the bed. So be part of our beautiful radio community. Anyhow, this program has been Bequency, Meet Bird People in the Hudson Valley. And I have been Mayuko. I'm here every fourth Saturday of the month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. So I'll be back on December 27th. I hope you can join me again. Thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your weekend.